call to order the joint meeting of the PSPRS local fire and police boards. Roll call. Mayor?
I'm mayor.
City manager is absent. Charles Erickson, citizen member, I'm here. Fire captain Paul Morales. Firefighter Anthony Love.
Present.
Police sergeant Cody Carmichael.
I'm here.
Police officer Justin Harris is absent. Any citizen comments? Seeing none. Next item is review of the June 30, 2019 actuarial evaluation of members for Glendale Fire and Police covered by the PSPRS. Lisette Camacho, did I do that right?
Yes, you did. Thank you. Good morning. I'm Lisette Camacho. I'm the Budget and Finance Director. You should have copies of the actuarial reports for fire and police ending for June 30th, 2019. I will start with the fire department, and I will just go through a few pages on the report. And right now, I'd like you to turn to page one of the report, and it's the summary of report.
And this is the fire?
The fire. I want to go to section two, a comparison of key results to prior year, and briefly go over the contribution rate. So it does give you a comparison of the valuation date of June 30, 2018 and June 30, 2019. For the tier one and tier two members, the contribution rate for 2019, which is the bottom number, for pension is 48.8%. There is no health component, and the total contribution rate for fire is the 48.8%. Below that is the funded status for tier one and tier two members. It does have the pension funded status as of June 30, 2019, at the bottom again, is 58.6. It increased by 2% over last year, and you can see that June 30th, 2018 was 56.6. There's the health component, and you can see the total of 60% funded status as of June 30th, 2019. The next page I want to go over is on page four. Page four is on the contribution rate. Similar to page one, it does a comparison for June 30, 2018 and June 30, 2019. For tiers one and two, we saw earlier that the contribution rate is 48.8, and that's a dollar value of $10.4 million for fiscal year 2021. And the last page I want to go over is on page nine, which is the liabilities and the funded ratio of the fire plan. What I want to point out is the actuarial value of the assets. That's about the middle of the page. It says ABA. So for the fire, the Glendale Fire Department plan, the value of the assets is the $126.8 million for June 30, 2019. And the unfunded actuarial accrued liability is the $89.4 million you see right below that. Again, the funded ratio is 58.6 for the fund. I'll pause there and open it up for any questions you may have.
So it's continuing to increase each year.
The funded status, yes, that is correct.
Great.
I want to point out that for the fire, there's no tier three members at this point. So if you look at page 10, there's no assets or no liabilities.
fire, are they showing no assets or liabilities in tier three?
There's no members at this point.
Not as of June 30th.
As of June 30th, 2019, yes, the valuation date. The next report that we have is the Glendale Police Department. I'll be going through the same pages. On page one, you see the contribution rate for fiscal year 2019. For the pension, it's the 53.24%. For police, there is the healthcare component, and that's about 0.5 or half a percent. The total contribution rate is 53.73%. Right below that is the funded status. And you can see that police also increased compared to last year. So last year was our fiscal year, June 30, 2018. It's 48.1%, and as of June 30, 2019, it's 49.5%. Again, on page four is the contribution requirements. The total employer cost, including healthcare, is 53.73%. This is for fiscal year 2021, and the dollar value of that is the $19.1 million. On page nine, talks about the value of the assets and the unfunded actuarial accrued liability. So for police, the value of the assets is $173.3 million, and the unfunded liability is $182.4 million. And as you saw earlier, the funded status is 48.7%. It increased by about 1% over the prior valuation period. And police do have tier three members, and if you go to page 10, I'll just point out that the funded ratio is over 100%, so it's funded more than what's required. And the healthcare is also funded at over 100%, 176.9%. Just as a matter of additional information, the city did continue its practice to submit the annual contribution, the full amount reflected in this report to PSDRS in July. I'm not sure if you all are aware, but we prepaid the contribution for the entire year in July with the assumption that we will be earning a higher interest earnings on the investments because we're pre-funding and we're contributing a large dollar amount. We also contribute for vacant positions. So I believe that contributes to the increase in our funded status because regardless if a position is filled or not, we contribute the full amount of the number of FTEs for police and fire.
And the center, are we still contributing for members that are active at INTROP?
INTROP, I believe, is different, but we take a credit for the drop. So if they're INTROP, we're not required to do all. It's different than this.
So I know you're not required, but I know back in the day when I talked to Tom, there was discussions over still maintaining the full funding. If you had 435 FTEs, we were still funding 435 FTEs, even those that weren't dropped.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Why did the unfunded go up between 18 and 19?
For police?
Yes, for police. As I'm reading it, it went from 172 to 182.
There is a lot of assumptions that go into the actuarial report. They look at the normal cost, they look at payroll growth, and that's the, there's a lot of actuarial assumptions in this report that I'm not gonna be able to talk about because I'm not an actuary, but I could assume that, you know, reason for your unfunded liability going up would be payroll growth was less than what they assumed in the previous report or the actual results were less. Also, investment earnings could have been less, so they may have assumed a higher investment earning. It came in lower, then that could increase our unfunded liability. And the same thing with the normal cost. So essentially, if the actual results are less than what they had expected, that funded liability may go up.
Okay.
Any other questions for me?
Does it look like it? Thank
okay.
you very
well, thank
much.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, presentation by the local board's outside attorney, Carrie O'Brien.
Hi, good morning, everybody. I'm Carrie O'Brien. I've been with you guys for a couple of years, so I hope today's training can be meaningful to you. You know, please ask questions as we go. I've been working with Jim and Vicki and Lisa on this over the last couple of weeks, so you know, they're going to chime in if I don't touch on something that we've discussed. Okay, so during the session, we're just going to touch briefly on open meeting law and conflicts of interest because, you know, you guys operate with three boards. I don't see a lot of issues on that. We're going to spend most of our time talking about the legal authority of the board and then get into the weeds on, you know, your routine agenda items, the non-routine agenda items. We're going to talk about cases. We're going to focus really on accidental disability. We've seen a lot, a big increase in accidental disability claims and what they look like when they come to the board, and then talk about the cases and then how we can improve the process. So we're just going to talk briefly about open meeting law. So Arizona is a sunshine state, so taxpayers are supposed to know how money's spent, and so they're able to participate in and attend public meetings. So obviously there's some exceptions that, you know, you guys use regularly a lot. So those are for executive session for legal advice and then reviewing records that are exempt from public inspection. So you are a public body and you're required to conduct a meeting and take action on business in a formal public meeting. And then the boards and any subcommittees that you might create are also public bodies. All right, so I just wanted to talk briefly about what exactly a meeting is. A meeting occurs when a quorum of the public body discusses, proposes, or takes legal action. And obviously, over the last few years, there's been a shift with the increase in social media and use of email on what communicating in a board looks like. So, you know, the standard thing that you see, you know, when you get communications, says, please don't reply to all. So that's one way that the boards try to make sure that they comply with the open meeting law. In 2018, the legislature amended the open meeting law statute to include the definition of a meeting that a one-way electronic communication by one member sent to a quorum of the board that proposes legal action may constitute a meeting. So one of the ways that I've seen this actually come up recently is with social media posts. So one thing, you know, obviously, I think you're all great board members and you know, you're kind of maintaining your role as a board member in a professional manner, but you know, just avoid, you know, email or social media posts that would talk about things that could come before the board or make it look like, you know, that you're predetermining a position on something before it comes to the board. And then the legislature also changed the statute that, you know, an exchange of electronic communications between a quorum of the board discussing, deliberating, or proposing action can come before the board. So again, that touches on social media, like thinking about, you know, if you post on Facebook, who are you friends with, and are they commenting on those things? Things like that. So can you discuss matters not on the agenda? No, only if there was an actual emergency, and this is really rare. So even with all of the COVID-19 pandemics, issues that have come up in the last 6 months, I haven't seen a board use an actual emergency as a reason to discuss something that's not on the agenda. And you guys do a great job staying on the agenda. So just a few things related to email and social media. You guys already, you know, didn't know about the not reply to all. Again, think before you post on social media, you know, does it look like you're proposing legal action? Like, would you say, Gary O'Brien doesn't deserve accidental disability. You know, that would look like you're proposing some action that may come before the board. And then, does your email or social media post contain facts or opinion that might come before the board in a future meeting? So I think just a general rule is to avoid talking about anything that would come before the board, you know, outside of a meeting. So as far as open meeting law violations, the Arizona Attorney General's Office has broad investigative authority. And so, you know, a member of the public can file a complaint against the board. It would come to the city, and then they would craft a response to that complaint. Any actions that are found to have been taken in violation of the open meeting law are void. There is a civil penalty for a knowing violation but from a board member, but usually when the AG's office finds an open meeting law violation, the remedy is to require training of the members. I've never seen the civil penalty used. All right, are there any questions about open meeting law? No? Okay. Let's talk a little bit about conflicts of interest. And again, you know, I don't think this issue is going to come up for these boards because really you have a very limited authority on what the board does, and you're not dealing with awarding money, which is usually where conflicts of interest come up. So there's a statutory prohibition on board members participating in a matter where they have a conflict of interest. And the purpose of that is to remove or limit the possibility of personal influence on the official's decision, and then protect the public body from self-dealing. So what is a conflict of interest? So it's if you have, or your relative, and relative is broadly defined under state law, so it's a tree that goes out with a lot of branches, have a substantial interest in any decision of this public body, you're required to make that interest known in the official records of the board, and then refrain from participating in the matter in any way. So what's a substantial interest in a matter? So the legislature has designated certain interests that board members might have as remote by statute. So those are not substantial interests. So the best example of that that commonly applies would be a board member who is a board member who also has a membership in a nonprofit. So if you participated, you know, in a nonprofit board, that would be a remote interest that wouldn't rise to the level of a conflict. And then you're answering these questions: could the decision affect either positively or negatively an interest of the officer or their relative? And again, relative is really broadly defined in state law. And then, is the interest that the board member has an ownership or financial interest? If your answer to all of those questions was yes, then a substantial interest exists. Again, because, you know, most often we see these conflict of interest issues coming up when a board's awarding contracts to entities. So you guys don't do that, so I don't really think this is going to come up much with this board. If you do have concerns, you know, about something, please go ahead and talk to Jim or myself about it, and we can just flesh it out. And then if you did have a conflict, you'd note it in the records of the board, you declare it on the record, and then not participate in the matter in any way. I think what we really see, and you guys have done a really good job with this, and this, I think it applies most particularly to the elected members of this board from police and fire, is the appearance of impropriety. So if you've had some kind of interaction with someone who has an application before the board, let's say for accidental disability, you were involved in an underlying conduct matter, that might raise the appearance of impropriety. It probably wouldn't rise to the level of a statutory conflict of interest, but just to avoid any appearance of bias, it's probably a good idea to talk through that with Jim or myself, and then you know, if you have a real concern that it might look like you would be biased in participating in the matter, go ahead and refrain from participating. And really, refrain means leaving the room, not participating in any way. And I've seen you do a good job on that.
Question, because the way I think that you're saying it is not the way that I've been taught in the past. What do you say, participate within the discussion or within only the vote?
So we, my understanding is that you shouldn't participate in the discussion or the vote.
See, and that's not the way, that's not the way it's been passed. I mean, you know, you have an opinion, everybody has an opinion, but until it's an actual vote, which is what makes the difference. I still, maybe I'm wrong, but I still think you should have an opinion and be able to voice your opinion and then refrain from the vote or recuse yourself from the vote.
Sure. Thank you for raising that. You know, and I know attorneys differ on how they, you know, train and advise clients. But just, you know, to keep everything as clean as possible, we've always advised it not participating in any way on the matter in its entirety.
The problem is, Mr. Mayor, with your comments, if you have a bias, you may influence the vote of others. So I have always also given the advice that if you have any interest or the possibility of an interest, that you refrain in total from participating in any way.
And I'm just going off of 8 years at the legislature. Certainly, if you were involved in something or had knowledge or friends or family or something, you could always let people know. So everybody understands, this is my interest. I'm going to recuse myself from the vote. But participating in trying to get the message out one way or another, I think that's something that, I don't know if the Attorney General would do if it would ever come to an issue or not. But it really comes down to, without the vote, it doesn't make any difference anyway.
But would it cover the discussion by the board? Not an opinion outside of the board, but about the discussion at the board when we're looking at an individual item.
So I think for purposes of this board, you know, we've seen, you know, when someone thinks they might have a conflict or even just that appearance of impropriety, you know, they discuss the, you know, when you see it come up on an agenda, discuss it with Jim or myself, and then, you know, if it doesn't rise to the level of a conflict of interest, which I think it wouldn't, but it looks a little funny, you know, it just kind of doesn't settle well, you know, and it's that appearance of impropriety. I'd recommend, like I've seen Justin do, where he just completely removes himself from the conversation about that matter.
And I don't think this is going to come up very often. The only time, you know, I think in Justin's case, it was a disciplinary issue. You know, I don't think either of you are going to have any of those types of conflicts. If it was a blood relative, obviously, you know, that's pretty cut and dry. But outside of that, I just don't, in the years that I've sat on this as a secretary, this was the only one time that we've ever seen anybody recuse themselves from it. So I just don't think it's going to be a big issue for us. So
right, and the most common, you know, times these come up is, you know, where there's money being awarded by a board, you know, to an outside vendor, and that just doesn't happen in this board. Okay, are there any other questions about conflicts of interest? Okay, let's talk a little bit about your board responsibilities. So, you know, you're sort of wearing a different hat than your role for the city otherwise when you're sitting on this board, and you are responsible on behalf of the city of Glendale to make the administration of the system effective. So some of the things you regularly see on your agenda are, you know, pre-membership, designation of those pre-existing conditions. You know, when the city hires a new firefighter or police officer, you review the medical records that come, and then you decide if, you know, some of those pre-existing conditions should be noted in the membership, so that, you know, if the officer or the firefighter comes back at a later date with a disability application, the system's protected from those claims. Obviously, you see lots of disability and retirement applications and then drop applications. So as board members, you're obligated to understand the PSPRS system, act to protect the system, and then receive information from both the city and members in order to administer it. This is just pulling straight out of the state law on what your authority and obligations are. So you're determining the rights of members for benefits such as eligibility. You know, we talked about admission into PSPRS and then retirement, you know, the different ways that members retire. You hear Jim, you know, every time we talk about action items, you know, he goes through service credits, so you know how many credits members are credited with when the board takes action. We determine rights with regard to disability, and we're going to get in a little later on the different types of disability that are available to members. And then, you know, with the backup documentation that you get, the estimates from the city, you determine the amount, the payment, and the manner of benefits that members receive. The board can also prescribe the procedures for applications and benefits, and we're going to talk a little bit later about potential changes to the application process, specifically for accidental disability applications, potentially collecting more information from the applicant so that when it gets to you, you have a richer set of information to make your determination. And then obviously, you receive information from the city just like you received about, you know, these actuarial reports for police and fire today. So, you know, the boards can be sued. When you can sue on behalf of the board, you are indemnified from personal liability by acting in good faith for administration of your authority. You can request and receive information from the city and from PSPRS, and then you also have the authority to appoint medical boards. And I think we're going to talk a little bit more about that later on. So one thing that this board, I haven't seen them do is, so you're required under state law to review members who are receiving catastrophic disability benefits after 60 months. You have discretionary review on reviewing members who receive accidental and ordinary disabilities. So what this would look like is after someone's received those benefits for a year, you know, after the board's action, you could require them to go undergo another IME to decide if they're still qualified. The board secretary would prepare a list. You know, you might get categories of the type of disability, mental or physical, and then set some criteria for whether you send those members for an IME. Some cities have created a subcommittee to use the elected members to review the list and make recommendations.
So those would be the two elected members from each board?
Correct. Yes. So some of the nuances with this, you know, very few cities engage in this discretionary review process, and some of that is because there's often underlying conduct issues with some of the members who then apply for accidental disability. So there's some ambiguity in state law if the board went down the road of requiring a member participate in an IME, and then let's say the person's sufficiently recovered that they can, you know, go back to their job, whether the city's obligated to offer that person a job. You know, the city might not want that person to come back in the position they were formerly in. So those are some of the reasons why cities don't engage in this discretionary review process.
Jim, have we ever reviewed a list?
We have discussed bringing those back. We've not done that yet. Do we have that in the works? I think we have it in the works.
We do have a list,
yeah.
And we considered bringing it to this, and then we moved it to a future meeting. But we will be bringing a list forward.
And it's part of the duties and responsibilities of the board to periodically review those, due diligence, that type of thing. So
and then one more thing. So if the board asked a member who's on accidental disability to go for an IME and the member refused, then their benefits would terminate. So they'd have to go through the IME process and further review to determine if they're still disabled.
But again, how would we know they had recovered if we're just looking at a name on a list?
Right, so the next step would be to decide, you know, what types of people you want to send to an IME, and then the board would have to move to send that member to an IME. And then it would come back to the board to review at a later date. All right, so we want to talk a little bit about a medical board. You know, you guys rely on medical boards to provide that expertise, you know, when someone comes forward with a physical or mental issue. Your boards also identify those pre-existing conditions when someone's hired onto the city. And then, you know, there's case law and state law indicates that the board is required to rely on that IME when they're deciding qualifications for disability. So really, it's critical who is your medical board and having confidence in them that they're, you know, reviewing every application independently and really putting together the information to put together an impartial opinion for you. All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about routine agenda items. So we already touched on this, but the board, you know, once someone is hired on for police or fire, you know, you see these matters come on your agenda to designate, to review the medical information and then designate certain conditions as pre-existing. So again, those protect the system if that comes back as a future claim by the member. Regularly see survivor's benefits for active or retired members who have died. Those transferred to the spouse or eligible children. Those appear on the agenda as an action item. And then you also approve normal retirement for police and fire. The drop is the voluntary and irrevocable retirement option for members who have 20 years of credited service. So they can defer retirement for up to 60 months, but continue full-time active employment. And then by statute, and the employees sign lots of forms, you see it in those drop applications, that they agree that they're terminating employment at the end of their drop period. And then the retirement benefit is calculated when they start the drop, and then they receive a lump sum payment of those deferred benefits, plus interest when they retire from the drop. Okay, now we're going to talk about non-routine agenda items. So these are the four types of disability retirements that are available to members. Accidental, we talk about all the time. Temporary, ordinary, and catastrophic, we don't talk about very much. So I just wanted to run through so you're aware what those look like and the tax implications. So for temporary disability, obviously one of the threshold questions we always ask is it a pre-existing condition? So then that would not be something that would qualify. So temporary disabilities are available for up to 12 months. 100% of the benefits they receive if they're given temporary disability are not taxable. And it's a job-related physical or mental condition that totally and temporarily prevents the applicant from performing a reasonable range of duties within their job classification. So it's similar to what we see for accidental disability, but it's the temporary nature. You know, I think a good fit would be, you know, if someone is starting treatment, but they're not to that conclusion that they're, you know, permanently prevented from doing their job, this would be a good option.
Okay, Carrie, does that come back to the board after the 12 months?
I believe so, yeah. So it's just up to 12 months. So ordinary disability, again, you know, we're asking that threshold question, was it a pre-existing condition noted when the member was first hired on? And it's a physical condition that totally and permanently prevents the employee from performing a reasonable range of duties, or a mental condition that totally and permanently prevents the employee from engaging in any substantial gainful activity. And this disability type is most different because it doesn't have to be incurred at work. And these benefits are all taxable. So they don't have that non-tax benefit. So for catastrophic disabilities, again, we're asking that threshold question, was it a pre-existing condition? This is not a mental condition. It's a physical condition incurred in the performance of duties that totally and permanently prevents the employee from any gainful employment. So you see little nuances, you know, between these different disability types, whether it's temporary, you know, whether they can do any a reasonable range of duties within their job classification, or are they really not able to do any gainful employment? So for a catastrophic disability, the first 60 months of their benefits are not taxable, and then depending on the membership, a portion of it becomes taxable. Okay, so accidental disability is, you know, the type of application that you guys see most often. The qualifications, again, we're looking to see, you know, was it a pre-existing condition noted by the board? Is it job-related? It can be a physical or mental condition. and the board has to find that it totally and permanently prevents the member from performing a reasonable range of duties within their job classification, and that it was incurred in the performance of the employee's duties. So, I mean, again, this becomes a lifetime benefit to the member, and the big tax advantage is the first 50% of this benefit is not taxable as income. So accidental disability applications have been the subject of the most litigation for this area. So I wanted to talk through the three primary cases that really impact the board's work to consider these applications. So I think there is also, at the end of the presentation slides, there's a timeline for each case. So the last couple of pages, last third page, there's a timeline for this case that just kind of goes along. So in this case, this was in 2010, when it was before the Court of Appeals. A firefighter was hurt on duty in 2006, but he had a lot of accrued leave, so he used that to work as long as he had his input. The employee was also a member of DROP, and their mandatory termination date was May 31st, 2007. So the firefighter was cleared to full duty status and continued working until the end of the drop period. And then a few days before the drop period ended, they applied for accidental disability related to that injury in 2006. So in this case, the Phoenix PSPRS board decided, you know, one of those threshold questions, that the sole reason for termination was the end of the drop period. And the Court of Appeals affirmed that decision because, remember, again, with DROP, you're agreeing that you're going to terminate employment at the end of that 60-month period. So there was no other option for that firefighter to continue working. So the court distinguished this. You know, this is kind of a narrow case because it was related to DROP plus a disability, that, you know, where the DROP period was ending, and the board found that that was the sole basis that that could be upheld.
Yeah, I think one of the other key components of this case was that the person was at work the last day of employment on full duty. He had a release from his position. He was at work. He was on the truck the day of his last day of employment. So it became very clear that he wasn't disabled.
Right, so that goes to that totally and permanently disabled and prevented from unable to perform their duty.
Gary, I have a quick question on this.
Uh-huh.
This is Tony of Fire Board. So in this case, this member did return to the truck and did work. What would have been the outcome of this case if, you know, this person's IEP said, you know, they were not able to return to work and do their duty, however it did line up with the end of their drop as well? Would it be any different?
So in this case, I don't think they ever got to the IME, which I think is what was critical. They made this decision based on, you know, kind of those threshold eligibility questions. So I think that's the reason it was upheld. You know, some subsequent cases that we're going to talk about in a minute really go to when you get to that IME, the board really has to rely on the IME. So I think the reason this case was affirmed is, you know, they really made this based on, you know, those eligibility questions, not...
Right.
Not really the medical evidence.
So at the point that they had to then refer to an IME, they didn't even do that.
They said no
IME, end of drop.
Yeah. Right, because the records that were presented to the board had a full release.
Right.
So,
right.
And that was the initial set of records that the board reviewed with the application.
So the other nuance in this case is, you know, in 2020 we get a case that says if a member provides any medical evidence, you know, I think they said a scintilla of medical evidence, then you have to refer it to an IME. So
right.
the evolution of how you look at this case is a little bit different now, you know, if the member did provide medical evidence, but at the time, you know, they decided this based on those eligibility issues, not medical evidence.
So, Carrie, he still got his pension. He still got his drops. So the only difference was, had he won this case, it would have been taxed differently?
Yes.
No tax on the 50%,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Right. So the first 50% of the benefit wouldn't have been taxed.
Right.
What about the drop funds? It has no bearing on the drop funds.
So they still receive them. Okay, are there any other questions on this one? Okay, so in Parkinson versus Guadalupe, this is a case that has similar facts to what we've seen in some of our applications. A fire chief was under investigation and resigned in lieu of termination, and then subsequently applied for accidental disability. The disability was not previously reported and was not noted in the resignation letter. So the question really centered around what was the reason for termination. So the Court of Appeals held that the statute of why someone couldn't retire for an accidental disability, it's not limited to one reason. So as long as accidental disability was a reason, one of the reasons for termination, the member was eligible for it. So essentially the underlying personnel issues did not disqualify the fire chief from accidental disability.
Right. And so, for clarification on this, and I'll ask Barry, let's say the fire chief submitted his letter of resignation and separated from the city, but does he still then have a year then to file
right,
for that disability?
Right, 1 year after separation.
So even if he would have left with just the letter of resignation, he could have come back in 6 months and filed for accidental disability, and as long as that was a reason, not the reason, then he would still get that.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
I think we just had a similar case.
Okay, but there was some other things within this case that led to that particular judgment. The notice of intent, the employee never received. So the claimant kind of said, I didn't even know I was being terminated at the time when I resigned. And so the courts held that record didn't support finding that he had received his notice of intent. So he was claimed he was unaware, and the city couldn't prove that they had provided the notice of intent.
But would that have made a difference since the disability only has to be a reason, not the reason? I mean, that's kind of hard to
judge. Just reading the case, I think it would have made a difference because he would have termed by means of disciplinary action.
Which is part of the statutory question.
Which is part of the statutory question.
Okay.
Right. So these cases get really muddy, right? Because the member submits new information, additional information as they go. So in this case, I believe the city of Guadalupe initially approved the member's accidental disability application and then actually went back for rehearing. You know, we've done a couple of those rehearings where additional information was submitted, and then, you know, they changed their decision and said the cause for resignation was that underlying personnel action. So another critical thing that came out of this case is that the board's decision has to, you know, if there's an IME, the decision has to be based on that medical evidence. And the board has to rely on their expert, who is the medical board that they've appointed. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Pasquarella versus Mesa. So this is the most recent case, and there's very similar facts to things these boards have seen. A member applies for accidental disability, for PTSD. There was an internal investigation, and the member initially said, I have PTSD because of this internal investigation. And the board said, well, wait, that wasn't, you know, part of your job duties. That's, you know, that's something separate. So then the member said, well, wait, I had an incident before that. I'm going to bring that up now. So, I think in 2015, they added a disabling incident, which was pursuit of a murder suspect as a rookie. They submitted additional documentation, but the officer sought no treatment until 2 years later. So in that case, the board denied the application both at the initial hearing and then a rehearing, stating that no medical evidence showed treatment of the earlier work incident. And while the event, you know, chasing that murder suspect was stressful, it was normal for the police officer. So the critical finding that came out of this case is that, you know, If a member provides medical evidence as part of their application, the board needs to send that person for an IME and then resolve any conflicts in the medical evidence based on that IME. The board can't rely on its lay judgment to resolve those medical conflicts.
Did they send him for an IME in this particular case?
I think that was the conclusion of the Court of Appeals, is that you had to send him for an IME. Yeah. All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about these forms that you guys have probably seen in your packets. This is the PSPRS, kind of a flow chart of how an application comes to you. So Vicki got these, the charts that are behind you. Those came from the City of Goodyear. This is their flow chart of how they process a disability retirement application. It shows, you know, the different rules and the information that's being collected. So the place where we land a lot, you know, in these boards is number five on top green, right? The application is presented to the local board to determine whether an IME is ordered. So one of the things I think the city's trying to improve is the process, the application process, right? Because, you know, once we get to the stage of an IME, you have to rely on that medical provider's opinion to make your decision. But sometimes the applications, you know, we're seeing like a shift in applications. The applicant provides a lot more medical documentation and a lot more information, but there's some information that doesn't come to the boards, you know, when they're considering these applications. So those might include, you know, the incident report from fire or police about what happened, what triggered, you know, the disability. So I think that's the claimant questionnaire that you have a copy of. And I believe Justin and Cody worked on this with Vicki and Jim. So it just asks the member some additional questions. I think the goal is to get more facts for the board to consider, particularly when you're looking at those threshold eligibility questions. For an application. Maybe did you want to say anything about the questionnaire?
Yeah, so our thought behind this questionnaire is when we get an application, sometimes the application is a skeleton. It just says PTSD and it has no additional information. And then we make it records, and sometimes those records aren't necessarily clear. And again, as Carrie was saying, once we bring that to the board has to make some type of decision. And what we're saying and what we're finding as we're looking at other cities and how they're processing their applications, they are obtaining more information before it ever gets to the board. This is a way for us to actually obtain report numbers, as we worked with Cody and Justin on, you know, when an incident happens out in the field, there's always a report number. And so when we provide questions back to the claimant that says what happened, what type of event was it, what was the report number, that gives us more information to go back to PD or fire and say, okay, can you guys provide us this information so that we can just validate that what the claimant is stating is actually true. Again, we can't control what the person says in the physician's office, but we have our own records internally. And sometimes for HR, we're not privy to what's happened out in the field or out in the department. And so this would be a mechanism for us to go out and obtain the additional information. Once we get this information back, then we can kind of validate this information, the records, and the medical records. And so we're coming to the board now with complete information and not partial information that we end up struggling with after we get an IME because we have learned additional information in between. So hopefully with the claimant questionnaire, we're kind of able to gather more information up front.
And this will be particularly helpful as particularly the PTSD cases that come before the board get more and more complicated. It helps to identify if there were a series of incidents or an incident that led to the PTSD claim. We'll have all of that information for the board ahead of time, and we're not sitting here, and you may not, you know, because we had one case where we were sitting in the board meeting, and the claimant, you know, we weren't sure if he was on duty or off duty. We didn't know, you know, when the incident occurred, we didn't know. Yeah, there's so many things that the board didn't know, and it made it very difficult. So we had to delay any decisions on that applicant until we went back and got the information. So what we want to do is make sure we have all the information for the board up front, so that when these claims come before you, you can make an informed decision as to whether or not you want to order an IME or how you want to proceed with it.
So in this process, and again, we borrowed this from Goodyear, and we just got this yesterday, and so we haven't necessarily plugged in our current process or what we plan to do, but what we were talking about here, obtaining additional information, is way down here. The first time the board gets it is here. So there's steps in between, but we need to gather tons of information here before we can present it to the board. And as we go through the flow chart, final decision on these don't happen until way down here, because there's so much in between that still needs to happen with these disabilities. Where in the past, we've gathered and jumped here. Because as soon as the board gets it, we order an IME and we end up here making a decision. And we don't have all the information to make a decision. Especially now with all of the PTSDs that are coming up. We need to really gather the information before we even send it out to an IME. So that when we send the information and the application and the medical records, we're also sending supportive information or information that disputes the claim. Does that make sense?
So another piece of lunch.
Is there a time frame from the time an application is filed with Human Resources until it gets to the board? Is there a limitation of how long that period of time can be?
It's 90 days.
90 days.
So one of the issues that I've been talking about with Vicki is whether the board can look at a worker's comp medical evaluation. And so we went back and forth. And so that can be another piece of data that comes before the board. Again, you rely on your own medical board's IME for making the ultimate decision, but just having more facts so that, you know, the board has enough information. You have the ability to ask claimants questions so that you have enough information to ask questions and, you know, make those tough eligibility calls.
So one of the other things that I'll pass this out, again, we got a lot of information on yesterday, so forgive us if we haven't kind of gone through everything in its entirety. But what we did track down was the procedures for Mesa Fire Police Board. And what Mesa does on every PTSD claim, when they get to the point of sending it out for an IME, they do a psychological IME and then do a psychiatric IME. So they do two of them.
What's the difference?
So one, and again, one can't prescribe meds. So one is just your psychological well-being. The other one, the psychiatrist will kind of determine medications and truly validate or invalidate the psychological piece of it. So they do two. And most of our PTSD claimants are seen two physicians. The psychologist can't prescribe medication. So they're seeing a psychologist for the counseling piece and then a psychiatrist for the medication piece. And so again, that's something that Mesa Fire, and I'll give you guys a copy of this, that Mesa Fire Board is doing for all of their PTSDs.
What if those two IMEs are in conflict?
Then you need a third, because someone has to resolve the material conflict of information.
And that could be a psychiatrist or a psychologist.
Yeah, and Vicki, let me just jump in and Chuck, to answer your question, we kind of saw this train coming. So during our last MOU negotiations with Jim and his team and the chiefs on the police side, because we did a horrible job of documenting things and we were trying to go back and research reports, we actually developed a police form on our side of the house for those critical incidents or exposures. So when those critical incidents occur now, the supervisors are supposed to be coming out documenting the report number, type of exposure, what time, you know, when the officer got to the scene, what they did, so that way we can do a better job of tracking this also, with the concern that some of the PTSD claims might increase over time. So to help with the psychologist, the psychiatrist, the local board, and the IMEs, those forms are being filled out now. So because of all that 90-day requirement and trying to collect all that information, it became kind of cumbersome to go back to try to, you know, piece this thing together. So now fire's done a great job over the years of exposures to fires and incidents. We didn't, but we made ours more specifically related to police, and that's a form that our supervisors are using now. So that ties into this questionnaire also. So that the member, if they're filing, they can go through the system and attach all the documents to this form, the checklist.
And that would be submitted to the physician doing the IME?
Yeah, the physician would get all relevant information so that when they go through the statutory questions, they're able to effectively respond.
Because right now, what's going to the IME is what the claimant gives us. And obviously, 99% of the time what the claimant gives us is supporting his case. Right. And we have nothing else.
So the other document you'll see as an attachment is this checklist. Vicki and I worked on this. And this is supposed to assist as you consider applications for accidental disability. It pulls out those threshold eligibility questions. And then we've broken it down to when a member submits medical records and then when the board receives an IME. So these are both draft documents, and you know, we welcome your feedback. You know, we want to make them really work for the boards.
And this would be submitted to the board by the secretary?
No, I think this is for member. This is for
so
board members
member
as you're reviewing. As you're, this is supposed to be like a guide as you're working through the disability applications. And then to just touch on those MESA procedures that Vicki just provided to all of you. So I just looked at this briefly, but these are similar to the rules that these boards revised a few years ago. So my recommendation would be, you know, if it sounds like the boards perhaps want to change what an application looks like. So, you know, to come back at a later date and, you know, maybe revise their current rules so that they match what the new application process will look like. So, and then just touching on, you know, obviously the boards have the ability to take testimony, you know, when you're considering those accidental disability applications. You know, if you have more information in front of you, you know, hopefully that can help you ask, you know, the questions and help you get to answer those eligibility questions. You can receive those medical reports of those on-duty incidents or workers' comp claims to determine causation for some of these applications. And then your ultimate decision has to be based on the substantial evidence that's in your record. So, you know, one of the, I think the goals of creating a richer application is to have a better record from which to draw to make your decision.
Yeah, and what we're finding, we did get Chandler's and Paris Valley on yesterday, so I've been reading that during this meeting, but they literally require that any application for accidental disability, that the work-related pension should include evidence that the applicant has diligently pursued in good faith remedies through the Industrial Commission, and that the applicant should provide all the work-related disability information, copies of the work comp report, medical records that were furnished to the Industrial Commission to the board as well. Because again, you're looking for the causation and the causal link between the injury and it being at work.
But do we give any weight to the workman's comp IME?
I think the IME physician would need to give weight to whatever records are presented.
Yeah, the board's going to have to make their decision solely on the SPRS IME that's been submitted. So.
But again, it would be hard to dispute from a medical board perspective if you have a doctor saying it's not related. And so that's our intent, is to provide any information that we can, any and all information, either to approve or deny the claim legitimately.
All right, so these are just kind of the rules that that I pulled out of those cases. So, you know, what's the cause of the termination? You know, disability, Pascarella told us, or I'm sorry, Guadalupe case told us that disability doesn't have to be the sole cause of someone's termination. But if the drop period was ending, that could be the sole cause of someone's termination. That was the rule out of that Phoenix case. The new Mesa case told us that if an applicant provides medical evidence that shows that they possibly qualify for disability, the board should seek an IME to clarify that. And then, you know, the board's not responsible for helping an applicant fix their application. You know, you're just responsible for evaluating it.
So, like, here, can you just go back? So, the termination for disability does not have to be the sole cause, but one of the eligibility criteria says that if you terminate it by means of disciplinary action, that's an exclusion to accidental disability. And so, you can't term by means of disciplinary action. And so, I think in some of the things that we do, like, I believe it was, which case?
That was the police case.
Yeah. Parkinson.
No,
The fire.
Oh, that was the Guadalupe.
Yeah, Guadalupe. So in the Guadalupe case, he should have termed by means of discipline, but they never served him his disciplinary action paperwork, and so that would have precluded him from actually receiving a disability.
And resigning in lieu of termination, which I think is what—it's
just a resignation.
Yeah, that doesn't constitute, you know, that all
disciplinary action. That's just a resignation.
So, Carrie, have you seen, or Vicki, do you know of any situations in which the employee knew they were going to get terminated for disciplinary reasons, but resigned in lieu of, but the chief had some factual base behind the reason for the resignation and did not accept the resignation? Or would our HR policies allow the chief not to accept that resignation and could move on with termination?
I've seen the other, where usually, you know, to avoid the cost of, you know, pursuing a formal termination, they accept a resignation. I haven't seen that other situation.
But that's on the front end, that might save money, but on the back end, it could lead to some questionable claims that could end up costing the city a lot more than one.
Yeah.
There's something to think about. Does our HR policy allow a chief to turn down a resignation or to deny?
Well, in general, our practice, and this is outside the scope of the PS Medeiros board. It's more in line with our employee relations piece, which I would work then with Nancy on something like that. But in general, we allow people to resign in lieu of termination. I mean, as a general rule, we allow that. Now, are there cases where we wouldn't? That's something that we could discuss with the attorney's office.
That allowance allows them to then
do this.
Right.
Submit for medical.
It does. If they resign in lieu of termination, then was there reason of terminating disciplinary? The answer would be no.
I mean, they could be getting fired the next day.
Yeah.
And if they resign the day before, they can go put in for accidental.
Yeah, and so that's something we would have to work on the employee relations side of the house as opposed to this side. But, you know, certainly, you know, Nancy and I could probably talk about that.
And I ask that because it's kind of a two-part question, but it does tie into the board's
ability
or inability to make a decision.
It does.
Especially if you can prove that they were full duty on their last day of employment and up until their termination, and then you come back and file for disability. It's how you say that you were disabled when you worked full duty.
Right. Well, and on our side, it comes down to, because the state statutes, if we have a member that's under investigation or commits a policy violation, they're served with the notice of intent of investigation. So they know that an investigation's coming, and once they know what their policy violations are, I truly believe after doing this for 14 years, they know in their heart whether or not there was going to be, they violated that policy or not. So then it starts coming down into the decision-making of, I better do this or else I won't get this. And I think we may or may not have seen some of that recently, and that's why we're, as the board, I know we have a fiduciary responsibility to the board and our fund and our members, because it's their fund. But we also know that on the front end of that, we need to make sure that we are closing any potential loopholes for scheming the system. I think the two go hand in hand because of how the morale affects the organization as a whole when they know people are
gaming.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And I know that, I know MESA and their board procedure says that they will collect all investigative reports as well.
Oh, yeah, I'm familiar with the MESA case. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem is because he was, there was no terminate by statute.
By statute, right.
But can the department, although being compliant with the statute, have their own employment rules that would maybe close that loophole and not allow that option to take place?
You know, ASPOS changed the administrative code several years ago that if you if they resign in lieu of termination, that now has to be disclosed to an employer that this person could go work for. So it's kind of
it's walking the line.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a tough one.
I think all of this, you know, the attempt to, you know, kind of improve the application process and these conversations, it reminds me of something Kevin said when we're, you know, working through one of the applications, which is, you know, to grant, you know, the applications to people who have, you know, true disabilities and then have enough basis and, you know, information to deny those that don't have any merit. And so this is just a copy, it's a screenshot of the form that, you know, when you guys are considering an application, these are the questions that Jim asks you, and you'll remember over the summer, you know, PSPRS rejected an application, you know, because of one of the responses to the questions. So it's kind of an assortment of whether PSPRS wants yes or no, but these are the questions that they tie into that checklist that we have created. And then these are just the timelines I created. It's just kind of like the facts that are pulled out of each case that we talked about today. So we just wanted to end with a couple of hypotheticals to get you guys talking. So the first one is a member applies for accidental disability when treatment is just beginning and the member continues working on light duty but has applied for accidental disability.
Well, if this is reference PTSD, when the earlier the treatment, the better. And that's what we've tried to do is keep them on light duty so they can continue treatment. And then we've typically followed the doctor's direction or orders on should they go back in full duty, should they stay on light duty, should they be in a limited duty. So we have kind of been applying that first hypothetical already because all the experts will say early intervention is the best prevention. So from filing for the disability. But we've been doing that on our end.
Yeah, so I think a couple of things, you know, when I was writing this is, you know, maybe this application's premature, you know. Do you know that the person's, you know, totally and permanently, you know, prevented from performing their job duties? You know, maybe in this case, again, the accidental disability is, you know, a lifetime benefit. Maybe a temporary disability application would be something that might work better for this person. You know, as board members, you have to review. Yeah, you don't get to choose which, you know, which type of disability someone applies for. You have to review each application that comes to you. But that was just something.
So if a member filed for the temporary, and they were temporarily retired for a year, can they come back to work if they're cleared?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, we've never used that.
We've never seen it.
But in this case,
that's interesting.
In this case, or there's not enough information to actually move that application forward because they're on light duty and the physician hasn't given a status yet other than he's just on light duty for a couple of months, he's just just continue working for a couple. We don't have a prognosis that says he's permanent stationary and this is it. He can never do his job again.
And maybe I misread that, but it says member applies for accidental.
Uh-huh.
I get that. We've had applications come in just saying that they've applied, but we don't have any information.
So the board, our advice would be to not submit that on?
Right, to deny it for insufficient information.
Right at the initial motion of approving,
recognizing
the application, just deny the application right off the bat.
Right.
Yeah. And then that
typically member, what we've done is just, okay, send him for an IME, and then they talk to the IME doctor, and they tell the doctor, I'm scared, I can't hold a gun anymore, and then the IME doctor comes back and says, yeah, can't hold a gun, yeah, can't be a police officer anymore.
Okay, so you're saying just deny that initial and let them continue with their command staff or whatever, working on getting treatment.
Right,
going
until their doctor
says
they can't work.
Yeah.
And that's similar to what I think we're doing currently. I think you would put somebody on a modified duty until they can get back into the field. But, you know, the board may see an application come through like that. And again, I think the recommendation from the secretary and from the staff would be, you know, deny. And with an explanation as to why.
Because again, the board is supposed to make decisions based on the information that they have in front of them.
Right.
And if they have an application that just says that the person should be on light duty, why would the board grant them a disability?
Question. I'm sort of taking that and thinking about both at the same time. What assurances do we have for our employees that if they come in and submit an application that's not complete, that the first thing you see is, you haven't done this, so we can't process this. You got to go get this done.
And that's
But let me finish. Can we go through that whole thing and say you need that, and you need this, and you need this, and you need this, instead of having them go out and get one thing, come back, and I still can't do it because you didn't do this, and then. You know, we learned that with our construction permits when people would apply, that we weren't giving them the whole story of what you have to do. We were just saying, no, you can't do it because of this.
Right.
And the frustration level for our customers, well, our employees, I think it's just important that we make sure we do all of that. And so you have to have all of this before you come back.
Right. And Mayor, that's our red box. Our red box is that when they present an application to HR or the secretary, then we're going to review it for its completeness and work with that person to make sure that they
submit all of the things that are inefficient instead of just one.
Correct.
And is that where this
checklist
comes in?
Here's your checklist. Let's get everything that we need from you.
And that's kind of, again, as we go forward, because we know that there have been some applications that have come forward where we didn't have all the questions answered, and that delays. You know, we've got to push back on the applicant. It delays the process, and so what we're trying to do through all of the things that we're talking about is we want to make sure that you get every ounce of information you need so that you can make a good decision as to whether to deny or move it on for an IME or, you know, whatever we need to do. So,
and my point is, we have to be 100% totally fair with the employees. To give them every opportunity. As much as it's important that we stop anybody doing something that's wrong, to make sure that somebody has something to do to them, that we assist that.
And 98% of the time, this is going to be, it's a very small percentage of the folks that are trying to game the system on it, but we need to make sure we have our checks and balances in place.
And so, I think maybe there's also something to consider is, part of this is more administrative, but legislatively, if a member applies without having a lot of information, other than maybe they went to two doctor visits, if during one of those visits the doctor diagnosed them with work-related PTSD, they have to file within a year. So that initial application might be very minimal amount of information,
but
they're doing it to come within the statutory requirement.
Right.
So would we see those?
That 1 year filing is for workers' comp.
Right. I'm saying that may be something that, don't they bring to our board as well at the same time?
No.
No.
They don't?
Uh-uh.
Oh, okay.
Well, the 1 year statutory after diagnosis is a workers' comp statute.
So for PSPRS, there's no time frame?
No.
It's within it's 1 year of termination.
It's 1 year after you quit working.
After quit work, okay, so yes. 1 year after quit work.
Not after the accident.
Right, which is why we have most of our PTSDs from an incident that occurred 10 years ago.
So I think we sort of already talked about the second hypothetical.
Can I ask just one quick question? If we deny an applicant, can he come back with a new application under a different category?
Absolutely.
They can apply.
He can come back with the same one.
Yeah, we can't reject their applications. I mean, we'll take their applications. We have to review every one of them.
Thanks.
Okay, I think we've already talked about the situation where someone resigns in lieu of termination, so maybe we'll skip that one unless someone really wants to do it. The last hypothetical is a member applies for accidental disability and provides medical evidence that she qualifies for the benefit. So what would the board do in this circumstance?
If she has everything else completed, I mean.
Right. And that's that pastorella, basically. So I think that's it. I really appreciate the conversation, and please let us know if you think some of these forms could be improved. We want them to work for you guys.
And we appreciate you guys helping with the checklist. Again,
you guys did an excellent job.
No, you did.
I added one more question.
You wrote it. All I did was, I feel bad because I literally wrote an email that says, looks good to me. That's all I did.
Well, you'd capture everything that we had talked about, and I think there was that one or two things that I brought up, but thank you, Vicki.
And I
it's fantastic.
Question.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
You did a great job.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Any board comments or suggestions? Seeing none. The next regular meeting of the Public Safety Personnel Retirement System, Local Fire and Police Boards will be held on October 28, 2020, 9:30 a.m. in the HR Training Room, located at 5850 West Glendale Avenue, Glendale, Arizona, 85301. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
Move. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? We're adjourned.